cost over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the US and other Western countries. Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization. But this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of MAPNA Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on MAPNA Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of MAPNA.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Daisy described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proved that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again. Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks, insurance vendors, real estate agencies, and sexist advertising, and then the end of the march turned into a multi-hour battle royale.
Tear gas is sadly typical of how our government deals with political demonstrations. French democracy has been tarnished worldwide and appears ridiculous, as it's clearly not based on representative democracy.
Over 2 million people marched nationwide as unions declared May Day the 13th major day of protest this year against a 2-year hike to the pension age, which was rammed into law by executive decree last month. The undemocratic proclamation of the law, combined with the shocking police brutality, had many French people questioning their country's democratic bona fides.
France allows for demonstrations, but the problem is that police don't allow it. We saw that with the yellow vests, and we have seen it again from the very start of the pension protests this year.
Macron has to stop showing such contempt for the people. As a yellow vest, I promise that we will never stop fighting for a real democracy. We want referendums and public participation, while Macron only has fear for the people.
International Workers' Day began in Chicago in 1886 with the fight for an 8-hour workday. It wouldn't be implemented in the West until after their political and financial elites forced World War I, which was largely an effort to maintain monarchical privileges and to forestall socialist-inspired reforms.
Protesters insist they can apply enough pressure on the president to get the unpopular law revoked, something protests also forced in 2006. Press TV's cameraman was hit by a tear gas grenade fired by police seconds before the start of a live interview from the demonstration. It appears like a clear case of police targeting media, as tear gas is normally shot high into the air. The cameraman was not badly hurt, as the projectile only exploded after it ricocheted off his leg. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It goes under the technical name of European Stability Mechanism, or ESM. It is the Eurozone bailout fund designed to help euro area countries in severe financial distress. The first ESM version was devised in 2012 following Greece's default on its own bonds, which brought the Eurozone at risk of breaking apart with economic instability spreading across the old continent. As Europe faces several challenges to stay afloat, the European Union must devise mechanisms to balance its member states economically. The European Stability Mechanism is a rescue fund for EU member countries that have lost or risk losing market access. In practical terms, it grants conditional financial assistance to states that are on the verge of bankruptcy to mitigate the contagion risks in the bloc.
We, of course, need to remain vigilant. Economic uncertainty remains high and we face numerous headwinds. Events in the US support the EU's choice to apply the Basel Prudential Standards to all our banks, not just the largest one.
In early 2021, the European Commission and all members of the bloc signed a new agreement amending the previous ESM in a way that it prevents small crises from escalating. On Friday, European Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni called on Rome to stop dragging its heels over ratification of the reform. As of today, all EU member countries have ratified the reform, except Italy.
By holding out on ratifying the reform, Italy is maybe attempting to fetch a better deal on the upcoming reform of the EU's set of fiscal rules. Some are even suggesting that parties in Italy's ruling coalition are caught in some sort of political skirmishes over this issue.
On several occasions, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has criticized the ESM reform, arguing that the bailout funds should be used also as a vehicle for growth. Some time ago, the leader of one of the right-leaning coalition government's parties, the League's Matteo Salvini, said that approving the ESM changes would mean the ruining of lives for millions of Italians and the end of Italy's national sovereignty on budget issues.
Creating wealth to tackle poverty is our top priority, as Italy has already sold many of its strategic assets and made a huge amount of debt. We must focus on investing now.
While Brussels is urging Italy's approval of the European Stability Mechanism, the examination of the bills for its ratification has been at a standstill in the Italian Parliament for almost a month. Max Civili, Rome.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with a number of poets and experts in Persian literature in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Wednesday, April 5, 2023. The meeting took place on the eve of the auspicious birth anniversary of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Poets, artists, novelists, cinematographers, architects, and those involved in various cultural fields should know that we are currently facing this plundering and onslaught of the enemy. They should pay attention to this. They need to understand what is happening, and they must also show what's happening to other people. They need to raise awareness about this, and they shouldn't be passive. Fortunately, we have a number of good poets today who are pious, kind-hearted, and believers in the religion and the revolution. Well, you are all examples of this. Fortunately, one of the good things that has been done by various organizations, those that are active in the field of art and also other organizations, is that they have helped to expand this kind of work throughout the country. Today, the opportunity exists for poets from all over the country, even those from villages and small towns, to introduce themselves and to go to centers where they can present their poetry.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Poets naturally are emotional, flexible, emphatic people. They should refrain from becoming emotional. They shouldn't get emotional when facing issues. They need to think and correctly identify the issue at hand. And they should feel a sense of duty toward what is before them. They need to fulfill this duty with their art. If they fail to do this, you cannot place any value on their art, no matter how talented they are. He said, "You are fine wine, but if do not leave the cask to enter the wine glass, what is the point?" This is a poem by Sa'ib Tabrizi. As one of the gentlemen here said, you need to enter the glass in order to bring happiness. God willing, may God grant us grand success to all of you and give us all the success of being able to use our countries and our system's valuable, irrepressible resources, including art and poetry. God willing, may you all be successful. I would like to thank all of you again, including Mr. Amir Isfandaqe and Mr. Qazve, because of their presentations. Even though they did not recite any poems themselves, God willing, we will hear their poetry in the future as well. May God's greetings and mercy be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron has warned against Europe being caught up in crises that are not ours and has called for Europe's strategic autonomy. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Global Times has covered this story in an editorial and tells us more. On his flight from China and after returning to Paris, French President Emmanuel Macron gave a series of interviews with the media and elaborated on the idea of European strategic autonomy in many of its aspects. He said Europe must reduce its dependence on the United States and avoid being caught up in the confrontation between China and the United States over the question of Taiwan. He urged Europe to become more committed to achieving strategic autonomy so as not to become a vassal of a major power amid the global crisis. He also stressed that Europe doesn't want to get into a bloc versus bloc logic. This is obviously a result of Macron's long-term observation and reflection. In addition, this is a view representative of Europe's insightful people in the face of the continent's current complex and severe internal and external situation, pointing out a relatively objective and rational path and direction in line with Europe's own interests. In the eyes of normal people, a European leader's emphasis on protecting European interests should not have become news. But in the United States and the West, many people act as if this has stepped on their tails and show a strong sense of discomfort and even fury. Such an abnormal reaction confirms Emmanuel Macron's statement that strategic autonomy is Europe's struggle. Macron's reasoning is not complicated and his attitude is clear-cut. From the perspective of a bystander, it undoubtedly helps Europeans to figure out their understanding of their own interests and the boundaries of European-US relations so that they can make the right choices at the crossroads. The numerous criticisms over Macron's attempt to divert people's attention weakened the impact of his successful visit to China and prevent this European introspection ignited by Macron from going any deeper. These criticisms and accusations are very cheap and not worth refuting, but the amplified noise created by them does create pollution. Some people want to construct a false Europe in public opinion to cover up the real voice and interests of Europe. The strongest criticism of Macron comes from the United States, as well as Central and Eastern European countries. This is not difficult to understand, but deserves vigilance from Europe. Central and Eastern European countries are at the forefront of the Russia-Ukraine conflict and have particularly severe security concerns, which has led to more radical foreign policies. But the dissatisfaction of the Americans with Emmanuel Macron reveals the true face of the United States. U.S. Senator Marco Rubio released a video of over 2 minutes in which he repeatedly questioned whether Macron speaks for all of Europe and stated that if Europe is not going to pick sides over the Taiwan question, the United States will focus on the threats that China poses and you guys handle Ukraine and Europe. Marco Rubio also demanded that France or Europe provide an answer quickly. These blatant statements cannot be called criticism or opposition anymore, but are Washington's completely undisguised bullying and coercion. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Emmanuel Macron has flown into a storm of criticism after he said Europe should not become a vassal and must avoid being drawn into any conflict between the United States and China over Taiwan. The French president made the remarks in an interview on his plane after a 3-day state visit to China, where he received a red carpet welcome by China's President Xi Jinping, a show of pageantry that alarmed some European China watchers. Speaking to reporters from Les Echos and Politico, Emmanuel Macron said Europe should be a third power in the world order, along with the United States and China. While the comments reaffirmed Macron's long-term goal of strategic autonomy for Europe, namely avoiding military and economic dependencies, his remarks on Taiwan stoked anger and alarm on both sides of the Atlantic. According to Les Echos, Macron said, "Do Europeans have an interest in speeding up on the subject of Taiwan? No. The worst of things would be to think that we Europeans must be followers on this subject and adapt ourselves to an American rhythm and a Chinese overreaction." Emmanuel Macron added, "It would be a trap for Europe, now it had developed more autonomy since the COVID pandemic, to get caught up in crises that are not ours. If there was an acceleration of conflict between the American and Chinese duopoly, we will not have the time nor the means to finance our own strategic autonomy, and we will become vassals, whereas we could become the third pole in the world order if we have a few more years to develop this. Emmanuel Macron said the need for Europe's strategic autonomy was now widely accepted, and there had never been such an acceleration of European power as in recent years. He also emphasized the risk to Europe of the US Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, a $369 billion green subsidy plan and overdependence on the dollar. However, he said, Europe had reacted with great speed to come up with our European Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, referring to plans to boost homegrown green technology and the production of critical raw materials. And Macron suggested the talks with Xi Jinping had been useful in confronting complacency on the part of China with regards to Russia. The goal of the dialogue with China was to consolidate common approaches over the war in Ukraine, Macron said. According to the website Politico, the Élysée Presidential Palace checked Macron's quotes before publication as a condition of granting the interview and insisted on the removal of lines where Macron had spoken even more frankly about Taiwan and Europe's strategic autonomy. In a social media post linking to the Politico interview, the US Republican Senator Marco Rubio said if Emmanuel Macron spoke for all of Europe, then the United States should consider focusing its foreign policy on containing China and leave the Europeans to handle the war in Ukraine. Marco Rubio, who lost the Republican presidential nomination to Donald Trump in 2016, said he supported U.S. aid for Ukraine, but if Europe was going to pick sides over Taiwan, a rethink was in order. The Indian news website First Post has also covered this story and tells us more. The White House said it remains confident in the US-French relationship after French President Emmanuel Macron distanced himself from United States policy on Taiwan and warned Europeans not to be American followers. Emmanuel Macron's remarks to journalists from French business daily Les Echos and news site Politico came after he was hosted for a state visit by China's Xi Jinping. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the Biden administration remains comfortable and confident in the terrific bilateral relationship we have with France. Spokesman John Kirby cited President Joe Biden's personal relationship with Emmanuel Macron and said the two countries are working together on so many different issues, including naval operations in the Asia-Pacific. Washington and Paris are partners in a concerted effort by all of us in this vast alliance, this network of alliances and partnerships, John Kirby said. In his interview, Emmanuel Macron said European countries, among the closest allies of the United States, should not get caught in the tense standoff between Beijing and Washington over the fate of Taiwan. China has vowed to regain control of Taiwan, while the U.S. government has pledged to help Taiwan defend itself. French President Emmanuel Macron, who discussed Taiwan with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Friday, 7th of April, warned against Europe being caught up in crises that are not ours, which prevents it from building its strategic autonomy.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is the first visit by an Iranian president to Syria since the war on Syria began. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has visited the country with much fanfare. A long-term cooperation agreement and a major oil deal have been signed already. The question is, why has Iran decided now is the time for this visit? And in that context, what does the forging of closer ties between the two countries mean for the entire region, especially since Syria is being embraced back into the fold by other Arab countries? Those are some of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me bring in Mick Napier first, activist and commentator, who joins us from Edinburgh. Mick Napier, welcome. So let me first initially get your reaction to this, because this is an important visit that has been done at this point. It's a two-day visit by the Iranian president since the war on Syria began back in the year 2011. What's your impression of it?
Well, the Americans have seized a part of Syria, which, surprise, surprise, contains most of the most valuable oil resources. America's trying to isolate and overthrow the regime in Damascus. It's ratcheting up pressure on Iran. It's trying to build alliances across the Middle East to isolate these two states in order to either achieve regime change or to bend them to the American will. I think the visit by the Iranian leader to Damascus is a symptom of something radically changing in the Middle East. We all saw how China was able to effect a reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We've seen the knock-on effects of that in Yemen already. But certainly in Syria, we can see that the efforts by the USA to isolate and force its allies in the Middle East to isolate Syria are breaking down. Saudi Arabians are working for rapprochement with Damascus. There's talks about reintegrating Damascus into the Arab League. And I think this visit from Tehran to Damascus talks of this is a symptom of this new situation where American power in the region is clearly declining, and its ability to enforce its will, divide and isolate the key countries in the region against each other, is faltering, is actually failing. So it's a visit greatly to be welcomed.
You know, when you first started talking about, when I asked that question, McNapier, you talked about the U.S. goals, which was to ratchet up pressure on Iran and going for regime change. But, you know, these are things and approaches that have failed, as you just said there in your last statement there. Why do you think the U.S. is clinging on to it? Because if you really think about it, which countries are on the U.S. side right now? You have all the, you know, the allies that were mainly Saudi Arabia being one of the major ones, who's no longer on the side of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. The only entity that is standing out is the Zionist regime or Israel and U.S. All the other countries are uniting. So doesn't that put the U.S. in an odd position, to say the least?
I mean, what a transformation over the last couple of decades. America really believed it could invade, crush the Iraqi people, could crush the Syrian people. And its whole idea was kind of mapped out as early as the end of the Second World War, where a key American diplomat said that Middle Eastern oil was, quote unquote, the greatest prize in the history of the world. And America was determined to dominate access to that oil. It installed a puppet regime in Iran, together with the British. It installed client regimes across the Middle East, because its idea was basically very simple. It's not that America needs the oil. America is often a net exporter of oil. But if it could control access to that oil, then it would exert tremendous influence on it, on Japan and China and other places around the world who wanted access to that key resource. Now, fast forward to the present day. The carefully crafted alliances, the day when Saudi Arabia would bend over backwards, with very few exceptions, but would bend over backwards to please the Americans, those days seem to be gone. And I think the view from Washington now is that the Chinese mediation between between Tehran and Riyadh was really contemptuous of the USA, and it did not give the dominant imperial power in the region since the Second World War, it didn't give that power its due place. So yes, the tectonic plates of regional politics are shifting, and they're not shifting to the advantage of the USA.
And in a sense, when you take a look at what has happened based on how you said a tectonic shift, you know, these regional alliances, you wouldn't think of it even months ago, because when you had this agreement and reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia take place, I mean, I don't know if we can believe the CIA chief or not, but he said that the U.S. was, in a sense, blindsided. But what's more important over here is a terminology that the U.S. Would hate for it to stand, but now it's stronger probably than ever, and that's this axis of resistance, which Syria is now back in the fold of the Arab countries and has solidified itself in that respect. How do you think the U.S. feels when it looks at what has occurred there? And to add to that, we have seen how Saudi Arabia, possibilities of Saudi Arabia not only reconciling with Hamas, but also in the past day or two, for there to have been some positive overtures when it comes to Hezbollah. I'm sure Israel is not too happy to hear this.
What a transformation. Back in 2006, when Hezbollah scored an astonishing victory over the Israelis, denied the Israelis victory, the overwhelmingly superior military force through the courage and the intelligence and the strategic and tactical brilliance of its fighters. When that defeat was inflicted upon Israel, the word in among knowledgeable individuals was that the Saudis were very unhappy and were hoping for a Hezbollah defeat. Now, I wasn't there in the Chancellery, so I don't know, but that's certainly not the case anymore. Look, every time an Arab state normalizes with the apartheid regime in Israel, they pay a price with their own public opinion, which never follows them. The Egyptians have had a so-called peace treaty with Israel since for many decades, but it's a cold peace, and the Egyptian people, in their overwhelming majority, disapprove of it and want to see the Egyptian regime challenge and stand with the Palestinians against Israel. So this is remarkable. I think the idea is, the question is, who will control the resources of the region? I think America has probably given up in its original plan to control those resources and to admit friendly regimes on preferential terms to those resources, whether they be in Iran under the Shah, in Iraq under American occupation, or in Syria or elsewhere. I think that plan is in ruins. It now has to try to sow... America's not like Israel. They're very different. But Israel can only exist as a state of 10 million Zionist Jews, a Jewish supremacist state, against the entire people of the region, 280, 300 million people. I mean, it should never exist because it's so tiny and weak.
Right.
It can only exist with an air bridge of arms and weapons and economic advantage from the USA and Europe, but also by devastating neighboring countries, by making sure that neighboring countries in the Middle East are weak and broken, as was the attempt with Iraq, as was the attempt on Syria and elsewhere. So any coming together of local forces in the Middle East, states and other actors who want to see local control of key local resources, who want to develop the Middle East, as China has developed in the last 50, 60 years. China used to be a basket case. China used to be a land of famine and hunger and different countries seizing parts of China. But China has developed and has become a major world power. People in the Middle East who want to share in the wealth of this wonderful planet, who don't want to live under foreign subjugation, who don't want to be suffering the threat of attack by Israel, by America's little Prussia, America's little Sparta, America's nuclear-armed Israel. Those people who want freedom and a better life for themselves through local control of resources seem to be winning very much against the American grand plan.
Sure.
If you take the long view.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me bring in our political analyst John Busnich into the program and get his thoughts on this. John Busnich, welcome to the Spotlight.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at what has happened over here when you take a look at this visit. And I want to come at you with the regional landscape of which when you take a look at the map and you take a look at the countries and how they've aligned themselves with each other, of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia being the big ones, of which then the rest somewhat followed, in a sense, you're only left with U.S. and the Zionist regime or Israel vis-a-vis the rest, especially when it comes to Syria. Tell us how Iran, especially in this visit, has solidified its relationship with Syria as the rest of the Arab countries are bringing Syria back into the fold, and then putting into question the U.S. presence. And, of course, in that context, maybe you could put Israel in there as to how it's bombing Syria every other day, it seems.
Well, you know, reality has finally arrived in the Middle East because with the assistance of China, the main consumer now of the oil and gas products of the region, we see China trying to secure a stable economic output that is not affected by the divide and conquer politics of the United States. The United States was trying to play Saudi Arabia off against Iran to try to break Iran's contact with China and with Russia. The United States has failed miserably in this effort, and the United States itself was being used as an actor by the Israel lobby, which we know is the most powerful lobby in Washington and which literally controls the majority of both political parties in the United States.
But McNapp here, there was a major cooperation agreement signed. It was called the Long-Term Strategic Cooperation. At the same time, you had a large Iranian delegation that accompanied the Iranian President Raisi in different fields like oil, aviation, railways, and agriculture. You have these Arab countries that are interested in investing in Syria, and Iran's president made it a point to talk about how it is interested, obviously, in the reconstruction. But how can any of this happen? Maybe Iran shouldn't be put into this question in that respect. When you have the U.S. and the sanctions against Syria, or sanctions against Iran for that matter, because some of these Arab countries, they're not under sanctions. So how can this part of the puzzle be solved in order for Syria to really stand on its own two feet economically and for trade to pursue?
You know, the issue of sanctions is reaching such a stage now that the last figure I saw was that America and its allies were sanctioning about 30% of the countries of the world. I believe, for example, that an American British delegation with absolute temerity went to Kazakhstan last week to threaten the government there that if they continue to trade with Russia, they themselves would suffer sanctions from America and Britain and the EU. So the sanctions have become so broad that they've forced other countries to look for alternatives to the US dollar for their bilateral trading. And this seems to be becoming pretty significant, at least in terms of an article I read in the Financial Times recently. I'm not an expert, but it seems that the sanctions are a weapon of war. Sanctions or pre-war. Sanctions were used against Iraq to famously or infamously kill 500,000 Iraqi children before the US invaded. And sanctions are being used to cripple countries, to inflict terrible punishment upon people from Cuba to Venezuela to Syria and elsewhere. And it's the imperial power and its allies which are inflicting this punishment. But it basically comes down to the threat of, if you will not be my friend, then I will punch your face. That's a paraphrase of a German proverb. It's threats and violence which are used, because the USA knows that in terms of producing goods, America was the humming workshop of the world after 1945. Now it's China. China is far and away, and neighboring countries, the biggest manufacturing pole in the world. And that's changed the balance. So America can only deal with its decline, its relative decline economically, by using military power and threatening the use of military power. And it does so very promiscuously. So any alliance across the region, in the region, between complementary economies in the region, benefits the people of the region, and it means that the American shadow hanging over the region becomes that bit less dark.
Well, something's got to be figured out there, because isn't it just John Bosnich when Iran signs, for example, a major oil deal with Syria, but you have the U.S. stealing Syrian oil? You know, that just doesn't make sense. And then making money off of it, I'm not too sure where that money is going, really. But, you know, that's just one of the things that's just perplexing.
America is showing itself to be the hypocrite of all hypocrites here. America is the country that is telling the world that it supports free trade and competition and free enterprise. And yet it is the single biggest block to free competition and free enterprise that exists on the earth. America has all of these countries under sanctions because it wants to use economics to dictate politics to other countries. It also wants to dictate culture and ethnic relations between nations which have been friends among themselves and lived and coexisted in peace for generations and centuries and even millennia until America came and set them at each other's throats. America has inherited the English curse of divide and conquer in the interest of their empire. And the world is now smartening up to this. We cannot be allowed to be forced to fight among ourselves. I was here in Serbia during the crippling sanctions that America used to try and crush Serbia. They had no effect. The people banded together. I was in Japan when America was sanctioning Japan and I was advising the Prime Minister's office. They did not cow Japan. Japan continued to produce. I have been in Canada when American interests imposed sanctions on our wood industry. America is the global bully. And as the nations of the world wake up to this fact, the bully, when it's outnumbered by all countries in the earth, will fail and fall. And this is how empires fall. This is the fall of America. They, by sanctioning the world, are sanctioning themselves.
Well, John Bosnich, I need to ask you how then this will impact the relationship that some of these Persian Gulf countries have. For example, how will Saudi Arabia be impacted by this, or the UAE, when it comes to their interest in rebuilding Syria, for example, making investments in regional countries, including Iran? Isn't that kind of a sign that it's the beginning of some kind of divergence in their relationship away from the U.S.?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the critical player in this matter, because this is an economic issue, sanctions are an economic tool to achieve a political goal. And China is now the richest economy, the fastest growing economy, the most vibrant and competitive economy in the world. And it is not subject to American pressures. These countries must trade with each other. And what America is doing with its sanctions regime is forcing the other countries of the world to band together for their own mutual survival. Given a choice between survival and profit, everybody will choose survival. That leaves America out in the cold, and it leaves the rest of the world to find substitute products to replace the things they bought from America. And if America sanctions them further, then the Russian and Chinese and Iranian and Libyan and Venezuelan economies and others will band together to cut off the things that America needs from the rest of the world. And when it doesn't get those things, America will collapse.
And final question goes to you, McNapier. As we've discussed, if we're looking at all these countries to solidify their relationship, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, as they are doing, along with Iran and other countries, and all of them really, to be on the one side, how can Israel then pursue its bombing campaign of Syria? Shouldn't Israel be intimidated by the fact that you have all these countries now, and they're interested in enhancing their relationship, and in the case of Syria, Israel continues to bomb them? Doesn't that put a wedge between, let's say, these countries and Israel, obviously some of which there is one, and will that make Israel think twice when it comes to bombing Syria?
Well, I mean, the price that we pay for American military adventures is massively high. They've just been kicked out of Afghanistan, but America paid or invested or spent $2.3 trillion in order to devastate Afghanistan, install a kleptocracy, and finally, after devastating the country, be expelled. So there's a high price to be paid to defeat these adventures. But Israel is a microcosm of America in many ways. It simply uses violence to enforce its will. America has always used violence. Bill Clinton apologized to the people of Central America some years ago for turning the whole place into a charnel house. America invades more countries in the world than any other, than the rest of the countries put together. So it's extremely violent, and so is Israel. But with the decline of American power in the region, with its America shifting attention to the Pacific, Israel will become weaker. But it will not abandon its position willingly. It will try to enforce its will, and the danger is it may try and seize the opportunity.